I really feel like there's a good line between what has happened and then what's going to happen. Traditionally, if you were in a company, you would look after it all, but I think a fractional CFO looks at what's going to happen as opposed to what has happened.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your company spend with magical features, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Phil Trotter, financial strategist, pointedly does not describe himself as a CFO, and maybe we'll get into why he's doing that. And Phil was one of the very first finance leaders at a very successful brand called Olipop. If you don't know what it is, you will by the end. And you'll also know a lot more about the CPG business and why you're basically crazy to try and run one of these things without a really skilled pair of financial hands to help you get through it. Because there are many pitfalls. We're going to cover some of them. Maybe you'll learn something. But before we get into that, Phil, maybe you can introduce yourself by telling us something about you that not many people know.
Hey, James, thanks for having me. Not many people know. Everybody knows I'm an Everton fan. I'll also point out that I'm an Everton shareholder as well. There's only 1,500, I think, of those in the world. I definitely overpaid for my shares, but anyway, it's a vanity thing, I guess.
Interesting. Okay, let me stop you right there just before we move on. So you became a shareholder, which sort of blends the world, right, of finance and fun.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Is this a vanity project? Like you say, you overpaid. Do you think you'll tell me the story about how you came or decided to buy them?
I mean, they just came. They rarely come available. And I saw online that there were some coming up. So I jumped in and bought one because I knew there weren't that many. And it was just before the freaking group actually bought Everton and their share prices collapsed after that. So it's probably one of the worst investments I've ever made, but still one of my favorite.
Well, you're dedicated, so you still fly home. Yeah. Tell us a bit. You're living on the west coast of the US, is that right now? But you're
west coast. Yeah. Flew. Moved over to Los Angeles in 2009, but moved down to San Diego in 2019. So on the west coast of the US, and been here 6 years now, San Diego.
But you've a bit of a history with the US. Like, how did you first get introduced?
Yeah. I mean, way back actually. So yeah, another kind of back. I actually used to come over from the age of 16. 16 to about 24 years old, come over in my summers coaching football or soccer, as they say here. So at 16, I was in a place called Normal in Illinois near Chicago, and then moved over to Brown University at 17, coached the summer there, and then ended up spending the rest of the time going to an amazing place called Lake Placid up in upper state New York, at Lake Placid Soccer Center. So I spent 4 or 5 years going every summer. It was brilliant. So yeah, so I've always enjoyed coming over to the US and so finally made the move in 2009.
And did you for your coaching skills as a 16-year-old, did you basically, you know, get props because of your accent? They're like, oh, he sounds like he knows how to play soccer. Let's hire this guy. Or do you think you got unfair advantage over the other coaches there because you just had the right accent?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, there were a lot of English coaches. So, right. But yeah, everybody leaned into their accent with their kids, and it must have worked because I don't think I was a great coach. I was organized and I got everything sorted, but some of the guys that I worked with were like just completely natural and just so engaging, and I had to work at it. So I think the accent certainly helped give me credibility.
Very good. Well, when I go abroad, if I tell people if I was German, you'd expect me to be smart. If I was English, you'd expect me to be well-spoken. But because I'm Irish, I just have to have a drink with you and maybe tell a joke, and then my obligations are fulfilled, which is much easier for me.
Yeah, I think I'm more aligned to you, actually, coming from the Northwest. It's definitely more aligned to the Irish than the well-spoken in London.
Well, we got that. So you have one thing now, you know, given that you seem to talk about Everton at the drop of a hat from my limited experience with you're obviously very proud. I'm sure everyone knows about that. But there is something on one of your trips that probably most people don't know that hardly, you cannot do anymore, which was a cool experience.
Oh, the last game? Oh, the Concorde, sorry. Yeah, no, so that was actually one of my trips to the US. I ended up going to London. I was late for my flight, London to New York, 21 at the time. And yeah, they'd overbooked the flight. And lucky for me, there was a guy ahead of me in the line who'd also, they'd overbooked the flight on, and he got pretty irate and he was like fuming and he needed to get to New York. And I would just kind of stand in the background. I was a student at the time, so it wasn't such a big deal for me. I would just get the next one. But he demanded that, you know, that they do something about it. And then when they finally offered him to fly Concorde, and he turned around, he said, and this guy too, because he knew that I was waiting. So So he just basically turned around and got me. So I actually, we left about an hour after our original departure time, and we landed about 2 hours before our original like landing time. So yeah, it was pretty cool. Like, I mean, you know, it wasn't long after that it was cancelled, and yeah, the announcement, the sonic boom hits, and it was like just sort of being there in a fancy restaurant flying across to New York.
Awesome story. I have a friend of mine who was in going on Virgin from Nairobi to London, and a bit like the guy you're talking about, he was a bit of a wide boy is the right description. He was a guy who knew how to negotiate, let's put it that way. And yeah. he managed to get a letter out of them because they had overbooked, saying he could get a flight from anywhere at any time, any class, you know. And he got back to London and he promptly booked. He figured out the longest trip he could possibly pick. So he flew to Hong Kong and then he flew to LA, you know, first class. And of course, you know, he got all sorts of phone calls and, you know, people trying to talk him out of it. And I don't know who gave you that letter. It shouldn't have happened, but it goes to show if you don't ask, you don't get. So
exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It was a good lesson.
All right. So, you know, you must be doing pretty well to get onto the Gross Profit podcast. That's what I tell people, you know, it's the zenith of many people's careers. I know a lot of people are waiting for it. So
it's been a dream. It's been a dream come true.
I know. Yeah. Wait till we start talking about purchase orders. Then you'll really
can't wait.
So tell us, how did you get into finance? I mean, what was your journey up into becoming a fractional CFO with a Northern English accent in the West Coast of America? How did you get there?
Yeah, God, I guess the quick version, you know, enjoyed maths at school, really wasn't sure what I wanted to do, was encouraged by like my mum and dad, basically, like the classic parent thing, going, you know, go do finance and go join something like that. So yeah, I went to Warwick University, studied finance. Then after that, applied to sort of the big six, as it were, at the time. I got accepted to join the graduate program at Ernst & Young to qualify as a chartered accountant. There's a bit of a theme here, but I delayed that a year, spent a year, decided to go traveling with a friend for a year. They kindly kept my place open. So did that. Then eventually started with Ernst & Young up in the Northwest. And they had their office was actually a Liverpool-Manchester office combined. So kind of spent, you know, 3 or 4 years just driving all over Northwest to manufacturing clients. And you kind of get a real good apprenticeship of like just how businesses are run, because you're just looking at all the books and understanding like how the different sort of P&Ls and cash flows come together. You know, it was a bit of a pain at the time, but looking back, okay, that was actually a great experience. And then sort of just after qualifying, I knew I had the itch to do some more traveling, and I thought about trying to get a secondment abroad, and the economy wasn't great. They put a stop on them. So then I ended up quitting, dragged another friend along this time. We went to South America for sort of 3 to 6 months, traveling all around there, and then landed eventually in Sydney in Australia. So there I joined Rail Corp, which was a branch of the New South Wales government. And so I helped them. That was when I kind of moved from sort of audit and started looking at sort of FP&A, forward-looking stuff. So my job was to help pull together all the numbers that we would submit to Treasury for, you know, to request budget for basically for the transportation, New South Wales transportation.
Very good. Let me double click on that. I'm interested in, for some reason, you're either in, you know, private business or you're in government. It feels like that. I don't come across that many people who've actually worked in government. So what did you learn from that? How's it different?
Yeah, there were a couple of interesting things, actually. One of them, actually, which was really interesting, I've never seen it since, was they used to list everybody's salary in the company. It was like public knowledge. So I've never actually seen that in the private sector, but it's amazing how, like, because all those sort of political tensions you find in some companies where, you know, are people like earning this or that and why, it was all totally transparent. That was I've never seen it since, but that was an interesting thing. But in terms of actually the work I did, and I do say it now, but it's my first experience to like just how much politics internally sort of drives sort of requests for money and things like that. So for example, you know, I'd be pulling together like what we needed cash flow wise. And it was like maintaining bridges, rebuilding roads, blah, blah, blah. But then after I'd kind of done all the analysis and pulled the numbers together, someone else came in and was, you know, they would like, they put the story on it. You know, it was kind of like, this bridge is unsafe. You know, this has got like a year left. This is like, and you know, so if we were asking for like 5 billion, they would come on and make sure we got that 5 billion by creating the narrative around why we needed it that would basically, you know, put them in a bit of a corner. Like they couldn't possibly say no because of what if something happened in the future and never got out, you know. So it was just really interesting the way they kind of like they took the numbers and added a narrative on top to help secure the funding.
Yeah, interesting, because fear is a bigger motivator than reward, or so I've heard. And I feel like in the private sector, you tell me where I'm wrong. I'm going to get in trouble with someone now, right? But like in the private sector, it's all like reward focused. You know, we can do this. We can get there. We can achieve this. We could get an exit. We could do a merger. We could do a thing, you know. But it sounds like it's the flip side. It's like fear actually might be more effective. It's like, well, you know, basically the culture is more about conservatism. Let's put it that way. And
yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think you sort of hit the nail on the head. You can't, you know, in a normal business, it's all about reward. But you just can't make a mistake, can you, if you're working in the government, because it becomes like sort of, you know, it's very public knowledge and it's kind of, you know, a lot of media exposure. So you're minimizing mistakes as opposed to trying to maximize returns, I would say.
Yeah, and there's a big, you know, piece of that. I had an interview recently with someone who works with housing authorities, and you know, there's a lot of controversy about waste, fraud and abuse, and he says, well, it's not necessarily waste, it's like contingency fraud and abuse. Like fraud and abuse is wrong, but actually contingency is a real thing, you know.
Yeah,
and there's no going back afterwards, you know. There's no way to fix it. You can't change your top line basically in the government. You do it in the budget. You got your budget and that's it, so you got to fight for it at that stage.
It strikes
me a little bit strange. I always tussle with this as well, how finance leaders who pride themselves on having everything penny perfect, but then storytelling is such an important part of what they do, you know. Was that a shock to you, or have you jumped the fence? Is this what you do now, like you tell this story?
I've definitely jumped the fence in that sense. I've realized that sort of the details kind of don't matter. It's more about the macro sort of stuff and getting the story right. So I'm you know, you can't make mistakes, and you can't, you know, but that's not actually true. Like you can minimize your mistakes and you can factor in that there's going to be some small mistakes. You know, don't make big mistakes. Be careful from that sense. But yeah, the story for me is that really is the, you know, I think that's what really makes finance way more powerful now. Actually can kind of differentiate you from just somebody that's pulling some numbers together.
Yeah, fascinating. And it's so powerful because it's such a leverage. I mean, the impact can be massive. I say, you know, if you're 2 to 10 million business, a fractional CFO is the most powerful hire you can make, because no single other person can have the impact on the business that a finance leader with the right story can have at that moment.
Just on that, sometimes it's not necessarily our story either. Like, you know, it's the founder or the business owner has the story, and you're kind of helping them verify whether it makes sense. And if it does, how does it fit together? And often the story might have to change a little bit because there is no sense to it, and I guess you kind of work it up between you, but it is crucial.
Well, speaking of faking it till you make it, let's talk a little bit about your experience in Betfair. Say maybe you can explain what Betfair is and comp planning. It's one of my favorite topics. You had an experience with some, you know, people who didn't read the cultural stereotype manual, and you had dealt with two sales leaders, and I want you to tell this story because I find it very interesting about two opposing views to sort of setting out comp plans for a sales team.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So when I left Sydney and then I went back to England and joined Betfair. So that was back in 2005. It's very early on. So it was a real high growth. And we had at the time, we had a German guy that was leading our UK and Ireland P&L and an English guy that was leading our international P&L. And I was at the time heading FP&A. So I was in charge of sort of building out the budget. And so, you know, we would always like start top down, like, what are we, again, sort of storytelling, what's the revenue got to be for the year? So we'd look at it with the CFO, we'd come up with what it should be, we think it would work. And then we go to the two guys. And so the German guy would say, look, here's what we think the comp or the budget should be for next year, you know, X million. And he'd look at it and say, fine, no problem. I'm going to get my team around this. We're going to go get it. You know, don't worry about it. You know, and then we take it to the English guy, and he was kind of like, God, oh, that's tricky. I mean, that's huge growth. Like, can't see it hitting that. You know, that's going to take a hell of a lot of work. You know, we're going to need X, Y, Z, you know. So basically, I just realized, you know, right there and then, you got German guy who's just like, we're going to do it. And the English guy, like, no chance. It's not going to happen. And I don't know if you've, like, you've probably been through these yourself, but then you just end up kind of, they become like iterative, these processes. Then they go back, they look at the numbers, you go back, and then, you know, speeding the story on, like the UK or the German guy with the UK P&L, he entered the year, he had a very easy budget process, didn't get any pushback, but spent the whole year behind budget, stressing, trying to hit his numbers. And the UK guy, you know, he spent 2 weeks of really intense conversations, you know, just basically getting battered, but came out of it with a very achievable low budget, and then spent the rest of the year basically smashing his budgets, and all his team get bonuses at the end of the year. The Germans team who worked in the UK, they just don't get their bonus. And I just was, it was kind of fascinating. Like, you know, I don't really know what to make of it, but it's just two different approaches. And yeah, it was just another really interesting way of people just managing their teams.
Well, I mean, I think the thing, lesson I take from that is, as a leader, you hear your sales manager say, yeah, no problem, boss, got this. It's very tempting to wave that through because that's what you want to hear, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you don't want them not hitting bonus either. I mean, that's just a losing situation, you know? So maybe next time someone says that to me, I'll ask twice and say, well, hold on, let's see if we can really get here, you know, because you want them to be successful.
It's the tension point, isn't it? Where it's kind of like, it's tough, but not too tough.
Exactly. It's so hard to get. We're continually, you know, we do quarterly rocks and we're continually either sandbagging them and going off. That was just, you know, a paper exercise, or no one gets it. You know, like we're just, everyone's, it's a bloodbath. And it's like, oh, what are they getting the, do you think have you ever met anyone who's actually good at that? I think I'm rubbish at it, to be honest. Like that goal setting piece, we all just want to kind of get over it and get back to work. And it's so difficult.
Well, it's funny because you, like, I'm now of the opinion that, like, I don't buy into now spending like 2 or 3 months iterating on these goal settings, because I kind of think it's a bit of a, you know, a bit of a waste of time. I'd almost rather just look at the big picture and say, look, these are the goals, make sure they make sense. But, you know, I'm not a fan of bottom up, but it also might be because I now work in companies at a very early stage, and like this, you're just never going to, I mean, like we always say, get it generally right instead of specifically wrong, because so much is happening that, you know, so much could happen that it's almost impossible to be right, you know, to get that. And you know, I don't, when you start saying, you know, Pete and Jane are going to spend X amount on flying this month, you know, I just think, just tell me what the team budget is for like the month or the quarter. And I think let's just leave it at that.
Okay. Well, talking about your more modern experience, let's say you had a great start, I believe, with, you know, one of your early customers, Olipop, which brought you into the CPG sector. So maybe just accept this. If you've never heard of Olipop before, you've never heard of CPG before, what is it? What's it stand for? What is it?
Yeah, so CPG, consumer packaged goods, that probably would be more likely to be referred to FMCG in the UK, fast moving consumer goods. So anything you go into the shops and you buy, can of Coke, bag of crisps, like just, or, you know, makeup, anything like that, that's kind of flies off the shelves. So in the US, it's called CPG. And I kind of fell into it, actually. So I was, you know, I was still working in gaming, like Betfair took me across to the US in 2009. So I was working for what was to become the FanDuel Group at the time. But I had a friend who started a drinks company up in the north, actually, of the US, up in San Francisco. And he started one drinks company with another friend. And for whatever reason, it just never, it didn't work out. Like, you know, it was their first venture. And one of the key things that they decided was, you know, probably problematic or tricky, was neither of them had like finance experience. So when they decided to go again, they sort of asked me to just, you know, not, didn't go and work for them, but I helped build out their initial models. And I just stayed close to the numbers, to any investor meetings, to helping explain, you know, the cash flow and where they were going to run out and what they needed and why. And just, you know, basically I was a, you know, a trustworthy resource that they could sort of lean on. And so, yeah, so they came up with this drink, Olipop, which at the time was creating a new sort of space. It was a prebiotic soda, you know, so, which now is sort of been branded as functional sodas or functional drinks. And in fact, even in, you know, if you go to the likes of Walmart over here now, they have like what they call modern soda sections. So the idea being is like, you know, everybody likes to drink soda, but like, you know, drink something that's good for you, or at least a lot better for you than your traditional sodas might be. So they're first in the space, and they've just done an unbelievable job, the pair of them, of just sort of carving out basically a new category actually over here. And so that was back in 2018. And I sort of helped them from day one. And now it's a giant company. Like, the most recent investment was at a $2 billion valuation. And, you know, they have a CFO and a full finance team. So I'm totally stepped away, but it's amazing to see how it's still continuing to grow and like just dominate over here.
So this business, there's different phases in it, maybe you can tell me about it, because it seems like you need to be at one stage brilliant at one thing, say fundraising, or another thing, you need to be brilliant at procurement, another phase, you need to be then turn around, be a brilliant marketer, and you need to be, you know, it seemed quite distinct, like, it, you know, basically it's, you know, you're eyeing six needles in a row, trying to get it all the way to the end, and at any stage you can be knocked out.
Yeah.
Tell us, what are the distinct sort of growth cycles of a finance leader in that as you go along? What is important at the beginning and what becomes more important later on?
You know, it's tricky because they grew so fast that, you know, everything you just outlined almost was condensed into like 1 or 2 years, you know, from starting in 2018 to, you know, to be doing sort of, I think, $200 to $400 million of revenue sort of now. It's just like unbelievable growth. So for me, you know, marketing, yes, you know, all those parts of it. But if I look at it from a finance perspective, the biggest thing was, they always say cash flow, but most people think when you say cash flow that, you know, you're trying to like count the pennies and make sure that, like, because it's a new business and revenues are low and, you know, how are you going to control what you're spending? Whereas quite honestly, the cash flow problem with Olipop was less about that. It was more about, you know, wow, like revenues are coming in much faster than we thought. And we're basically having to buy all this raw material, you know, and there's a big long cash conversion cycle. So you got to buy all this raw material and use all this cash to basically be able to have the inventory to supply the sales team. So, you know, the cash flow, which I'd never seen before, was all about the success of the company. That's what made it tricky. Not because you were sort of missing your revenues every week, which is what I think traditionally people would expect.
Okay, so in other words, the selling the stuff seemed like it was a solved problem. If you got it onto the shelves, if you managed to get it that far, it would sell. It was all the pieces leading up to that. And because retailers, you know, they, in the early stages, you know, do they even pay for the drinks? Like, don't you have to rent space on the shelf and all this sort of stuff when you were trying to establish a brand? And how did that
I don't know what it's like in the UK. Okay. So that might be so. But in the US, you kind of like, you go through some of the major distributors, and then they, you know, you still do the deal with the retailers, but you go through a distributor and then they kind of put the drinks on the shelves. But I will, you know, defer to all the sales team. And I like the fact that, you know, you say you just put it on the shelf and it sold itself. Cause I'm sure if you had the sales guy sat here, he'd be like, oh my God, like, are you kidding me? But, you know, let's just assume it's such a great tasting product that let's just assume that is right. So the case was that, you know, they just had to get it onto the shelf. Yeah. And then what was happening was, I mean, if I just go back to what we're talking about really about the goal setting, you know, that's where the cash crunch came in, because you've got to make sure that you're accurately setting these revenue targets, because you've got to reverse engineer what inventory you're going to need, and you're going to need 2 or 3 months lead time to do that. And that is what kind of, you know, that's what became the challenge.
Okay. So now let's talk about the thing that everyone's been waiting for, which is to ask you, how do purchase orders fit into this story? Are they important in this type of business, and what role do they play?
Yeah. I'm glad you asked. It actually is true that we probably didn't use purchase orders, or we definitely didn't use them as we should, and we nearly got caught out by it. But yeah, so really, I would say, and it was a few years ago now, but it was during a very hyper growth period. You know, we had these low sort of, we didn't think of it at the time, but now looking back, you know, certainly lowish revenue targets. So the inventory we were building wasn't enough. So of course the sales team are frantic and they're going crazy, because the last thing they want to do is basically short these orders. So we had our sit down. We said, right, okay, this sales forecast is nowhere near enough. So we worked with them to just bump it right up. And then after we came up with this new forecast, we decided, you know, we're going to add another like 10 to 20% on top of that to send it to give it to the ops team. because we want to make sure they've got enough. Unbeknownst to us, the ops team took the number and we're like, we're going to add 10 or 20% to this because we want to make sure we don't short those guys. So they took a number and then they added. So they started to buy all this inventory that was now sort of 40 to 50% higher than, you know, than what we were expecting. So they were sort of buying all this inventory. And then all of a sudden it just starts to land. And we're getting all these invoices for all this inventory that's landed. And, you know, it's just like, we've got like $1 million invoices coming in, which we weren't even expecting. And it just made me realize that, like, you know, like we didn't have a PO system set up that we were following. And what we needed was, if we had somebody like sort of telling us that they'd raise these orders and it was coming, A, we might have been able to like fix that communication gap between sales, the business and ops. And B, we would be prepared for it. As it happened, we just had to, you know, scramble to like raise some more debt, get some funding in, and actually like make sure that we were, you know, we had the cash that was required to take us through this next phase of the journey. I mean, it was never going to be a problem, because when you're in a company where revenues are growing so well, everything's fixable. But, you know, I could imagine if that same issue had occurred in a company with static revenues or at worst declining revenues, then it would have been a real issue.
I have to answer. Hats off to you, Phil. I've been selling purchase orders for 11 years, and this is a new story. It's yet another application for how purchase orders can help you. And another success story. Because you're 100% welcome. Right. If you're not, you think you have a plan, but if you're not using orders to get visibility on what's going to come down, you're just reacting to invoices. People, you know, approve invoices as if that's somehow being in control of your spend. It's not.
Well, you realize, don't you, that like, you know, the traditional finance system, it only, as you expect, just it only includes what you know or what you've received. And, you know, the hidden costs are all those things that people have committed to that you don't know about, you know, and that's where you get caught out. And that's, you know, and when you're growing fast, those can be big numbers.
So you are not a CFO. Well, you don't describe yourself as a CFO. You say you're a financial strategist. Yeah. Why? What's going on there?
It's funny. So, I mean, I do accept that everybody would sort of call me a fractional CFO, and I totally get it. The reason I don't always align to that is because it sets the expectation of sort of someone being sat in the business, managing a finance team, managing tax, managing sort of, you know, governance and regulation, etc. But really what I do is I focus totally on sort of the next stage, what's going to happen, the forward-looking stuff. So, you know, take the business, let's forecast, you know, what it's going to look like, how much money you're going to need, when you're going to need funding, what might your valuation look like at each of these next few stages of growth, so that the founder's not, you know, basically giving away their business and they're managing to withhold sort of, you know, most of the equity. And so and because I'm fractional, you know, I always find that that's, you know, it's a lot easier to be much more specific and focus on that side of the business than, I don't really think a fractional CFO can come in and say lead a team or, you know, or deal with some of these other parts of the business, because you need somebody that's, you know, day to day in the business operating like that. So anyway, that's my sort of why I kind of tend to look at it as, you know, financial strategy or strategic finance as opposed to a fractional CFO.
You're dead right. I mean, everyone acknowledges it's a sort of a shingle that anyone can hang out from, and all sorts of backgrounds, all equally valid, you know, all doing different parts of the piece of finance function. But, you know, some people get a bit shirty, like they're saying, hey, why is that person calling themselves a fractional CFO? Like they're, you know, they're doing, I don't know, even FP&A. Yeah. Some people would say that's not really, you know, that's not strategic enough, you know, or, you know, other people look sideways at bookkeeping or whatever, you know, and it's time to sort of break it down a little more for the public, if you like. We need to educate people better about the different roles. Certainly, before I started this, I really knew there were controllers, I knew there were CFOs, I knew there were bookkeepers, I knew there were tax accountants, but the general civilians don't know really what the difference between those things are. Even sometimes quite seasoned professionals, you know, it's like myself, I might say, you know, it's not their fault. It's not anyone's fault. Yeah. It's just we're not communicating.
It's true. Because I was just going to say that I really feel like there's a good line between there's what has happened and then what's going to happen. And so, you know, I kind of agree with you. You know, traditionally, if you were in a company, you would look after it all. But I think a fractional CFO looks at what's going to happen as opposed to what has happened.
I like it. So to wrap up, tell us, like, who's your ideal customer now? Maybe people have been with us for half an hour, and, you know, so they're still here. So if they're here, they're pretty dedicated. Tell us, who should reach out to you? You know, who's the ideal customer you love to work with, and how can I get in touch?
Yeah. So CPG, mainly drinks brands, but certainly would extend beyond that. Usually anybody that is probably, I don't know, maybe 3 to 4 million already in revenue. You know, they've got their check from their bigger check from an investment round. They've proved their product. And what they're trying to do is they've got a bookkeeper and they've got people that are actually pulling the numbers together, but they just need that kind of like that extra layer of financial support to start to map out basically like the journey over the next 3 to 5 years of exactly how they want to grow the business. So yeah, so that's what I help brands with.
Very good. Thanks very much, Phil. And thank you for listening. If you're still with us, given that you got talking to the listeners, Phil, what I like to do is give them a little bonus at the end. I don't want them to come all this way, you know, and not go away empty handed. So what I'm giving away this week is a subscription to our newsletter. Now, I know what you're thinking. Not a bloody newsletter. I don't want another bloody newsletter. Well, our newsletter is different. Not only do you get updates on the upcoming podcast from the Growth Profit podcast, keep up to date with great advice from people like Phil and other experts, but I've also figured out the success to people reading my newsletter, which is to scour the news for examples of waste, fraud, and abuse, basically financial bloopers. We're not too fancy about it. I get the best ones together. I put them in the newsletter. So I won't lie, it's a little bit vicarious. You know, Naomi Campbell's been in there for a little bit mismanagement of her charitable organization that she sent up. You know, we have stories from local government, maybe a couple of them in Australia. Actually, we've had examples from startups, you know, CEOs who run away with the money, with the investor's money. We have stories from other just everyday mistakes that sometimes people end up in jail for. So in order to avoid it, it's good if you sign up for our newsletter, just so you know what's going on out there. And also you might get a little bit of vicarious entertainment at the same time. You can sign up at procurementexpress.com/newsletter and you will be very welcome. You can thank me later. Phil, this was, I have to say, I really enjoyed this one. You're very entertaining. You explain things very clearly. Thank you very much for being on the show.
Likewise, James. Thanks very much for having me.